It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Over the past 40 years, Wisconsin has experienced one of the steepest long-term declines in union membership in the United States. In 1985, nearly half of public sector workers in Wisconsin belonged to a union, along with more than 17% in the private sector. Now, 15 years after the passage of Act 10, that rate has dipped to under 20% of public workers, less than 5% of the private sector unionized in Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll hear from a Wisconsin labor economist about the legacy of Act 10 and current union efforts around the state. First, a new report digs into this union membership data from around the country, including the story here in Wisconsin. It's called States of the Unions, the Shifting Geography of U.S. Labor. Haley Brown is a labor and disability researcher with the Center for Economic and Policy Research and the author of the study. Haley, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, in your report, you see the union membership rate nationally going down 18% in 1985 to 10% in 2025. But you point out there's a lot of variation from place to place, state by state, and Wisconsin is a dramatic part of the story. What do you see happening in Wisconsin over that time frame?
Specifically post-2011, Wisconsin's trajectory is neither a continuation of a pre-existing trend, nor is it shared by its peer states, and it is distinct from the rest of the nation. Wisconsin used to be a solidly unionized state, and it's arguably not anymore. Its union density drop in terms of percentage points was the largest in the nation between 1985 and 2025. In 1985, it was 12th overall in union membership. So that means one in four people in Wisconsin belong to a union. And that has fallen to roughly one in 16 workers being members of the union in 2025. By 2025, Wisconsin ranked 30th overall in the nation in terms of union density. And this drop was especially pronounced in the public sector. There was definitely a national trend of gradual union decline, but Wisconsin fell faster and further than almost anywhere else, and it had further to fall.
You foreshadowed one of the reasons, I think, behind that by mentioning the year 2011. That's the year that Act 10 passed in Wisconsin, a big change to rules for public employee unions. Do you see that as a big thing driving that unusually large drop here in Wisconsin?
Yes, absolutely. So Wisconsin's worst five-year window within that 1985 to 2025 period was 2011 to 2015. And their drops during 2011 to 2015 were 3 to 4 times larger than most other states. Wisconsin, unfortunately, it occupies a rare position in the sense that it was a genuinely unionized state, and it experienced some of the most dramatic declines in the country. And I think there's an instructive comparison here to try to get at how instrumental 2011 was for Wisconsin. So in Ohio, there was a bill called Senate Bill 5, which would have imposed similar restrictions to Act 10 in Wisconsin. Ohio Governor John Kasich passed it in March 2011, but it was actually repealed by referendum in November 2011. So when you look at Ohio versus Wisconsin, Ohio's public sector union density specifically doesn't show a comparable collapse to Wisconsin. And so it's a really instructive natural experiment, if you will, that demonstrates the extent to which something like Act 10 can dramatically affect union density. Wisconsin's drop was roughly 20 times the average national decline in the public sector. And a lot of that was concentrated around 2011. Their post-2011 trajectory wasn't a continuation of a pre-existing trend. If you look at it like on a chart, it's a huge, huge cliff drop.
What do you see when it comes to private sector union membership in Wisconsin as you look over this time frame?
Private sector union membership in Wisconsin is much closer to the national average, and it's closer to what you see in peer Midwestern states, whereas public sector union membership and union coverage in Wisconsin, there is a dramatic cliff in 2011. And it's interesting when you sort of divide it out by sector like that, just because if you look at its peer Midwestern states, they have similar trends in the private sector to Wisconsin, but that 2011 public sector cliff just doesn't exist in those other states.
And in 2015, Wisconsin passed its version of what are sometimes called right-to-work laws, which makes private sector unionization more difficult. Do you see as dramatic a drop in private sector in that year as you do with public sector with Act 10 in 2011?
No, you don't. And this is true for other states too. So if you look at states like Michigan and Indiana, when they were doing right to work things, there's mixed evidence to what extent right to work laws versus the environments that the sort of anti-worker environments that help produce right to work laws are the main driver of some of the effects of right to work laws. But you don't see anything like a huge cliff for the following right to work laws in either Wisconsin or in, say, Indiana or Michigan. Act 10 was categorically different than right to work laws. So right to work affect private sector organizing and dues collection, but they don't strip collective bargaining rights the way that Act 10 did. Act 10 eliminated most public sector unions' ability to bargain over anything except base wages, and it required annual recertification votes. And that has a much more dramatic effect on unions' ability not to just grow and organize new members, but to even maintain their current membership levels relative to something that potentially affects their resources, but doesn't get at the heart of what the union is trying to do the same way that something like stripping their ability to collectively bargain over most important topics does.
Now, for someone listening who's never been part of a union, public or private, they might hear this and think, oh, well, it's interesting, a big change in Wisconsin. But so what? What is the impact? What do you see as the outcome, the impact on the state as a whole with this dramatic drop in union membership?
There is tons and tons of research. I've done some of it. Many of my colleagues have done research on just how much unions benefit the workers who belong to them. They systematically raise wages. They improve access to important benefits like healthcare and pensions. And so when you see drops in unionization, that corresponds with drops in job quality. And it's especially important in the public sector because traditionally the public sector has been more highly unionized, and it's also been a source of more stable jobs for a lot of people, particularly people who are disabled, people who come from marginalized backgrounds. Black workers are overrepresented in the public sector. Seeing attacks on public sector unions not only is going to have a disproportionate effect on unionization rates overall because the public sector is more highly unionized traditionally, it's also going to negatively affect job quality overall by pushing down that union membership rate in general.
And Haley, have you seen any places around the country or sectors where unionization has leveled out or even gone back up? Are there any, from a pro-union perspective, I guess, are there any bright spots you're seeing?
Yeah, in the public sector, the decline has been much more gradual, and there were some states that managed to have slightly higher levels in 2025 versus 1985. I think Hawaii was one of them. The only state that had higher, like even slightly higher overall unionization rates in 2025 relative to 1985 was Vermont. And it was basically flat. I think it was by a tenth of a percentage point. So the unionization rate in the United States has declined over time. I'm hoping that that's fairly well known, and it is an unfortunate thing in the sense that unions correspond with improvements in job quality. But in the public sector, at least in some states, it has remained flat or even gone up during that period. Unfortunately, Wisconsin has not been one of those states.
Haley, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much again for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Haley Brown is a labor and disability researcher with the Center for Economic and Policy Research. We've been talking about her new report, States of the Unions, the Shifting Geography of U.S. Labor, showing that Wisconsin has seen one of the sharpest drops in union membership around the country, with the passage of Act 10 in 2011 as a major driver. Now for a look at the legacy of Act 10 15 years later and the current state of union efforts, we're joined by John Haywood, Distinguished Professor of Economics and Director of the Graduate Program in Human Resources and Labor Relations at UW-Milwaukee. John, thanks for joining us.
Rob, my pleasure to be with you.
We're marking 15 years since the passage of Act 10 this month. It was a budget repair bill. It was how it was billed, introduced by former Governor Scott Walker. Remind us of the changes, the restrictions, and those collective bargaining rights we were just hearing about for public sector employees. What change did that make?
Well, there are a lot of things that changed. I guess the first thing that changed was the public sector workers were responsible for a greater share of their retirement benefits and their health insurance. That amounted to about a 9% decline in after take-home pay. There were a lot of restrictions on what the remaining unions could bargain over. They couldn't bargain over benefits. They couldn't bargain over the safety on the job. They couldn't bargain on working conditions. The only thing they could bargain on was their pay, and that was limited by law to never exceed the rate of inflation. And the other thing that was sort of so fundamental was that every union was required to have a complete recertification vote every year. So the consequence of that was that many, many public sector unions simply vanished.
And that, would you say Act 10 is the main or sole cause of that drop in public employee union membership in Wisconsin that Haley was just talking about? With those restrictions, it sounds like that could have a big impact.
It had an enormous impact, and those of us watching the numbers, as Haley indicated, saw it happen immediately and continued dramatically over a short period of time. I think there may be a couple of points to make in general. One important point is that Act 10 is part of a broader phenomenon in the state of Wisconsin, in which we've gone from a high-spending, high-tax state to a low-spending, low-tax state. And it's no question that Act 10 was part of that, but it was not the only thing that was part of that.
And that was part of the argument at the time that, hey, if the state and local governments and schools didn't have to deal with that full collective bargaining power, it was going to be a savings for taxpayers. Government units at all levels in the state would have to pay less. As you look back over 15 years ago, how do you see the balance of that and those savings we may have gotten versus what we may have lost in terms of employee quality, the number of employees who want to work in Wisconsin? How do you balance the impact of Act 10 as you look back over this 15-year span?
Rob, that's an excellent question. I mean, you're right. The proponents felt that there were $16 billion in savings for taxpayers. At the same time, you know, just to go back to this broader theme, the state of Wisconsin moved from the third highest state and local tax burden in the country to the 35th. I don't think enough Wisconsinites understand that. So we're a low-tax, low-spend state. And in some places, you know, we're kind of holding our own. We're roughly 26th in K-12 spending, but we're 44th in university spending. We're 50th in state park spending. That's dead last, by the way. My own view is that some things have been lost and some things have been gained. I don't think the state can afford to have the third highest tax burden as we did 20-something years ago. On the other hand, I would like to see some of those basic public services have us spend more on. And part of having us spend more on that were the ability of workers to talk about how to do their jobs well, how to be a successful teacher, and for school districts to have a process for learning that from teachers or even from public works employees. To some extent, what's been lost, I know Haley wanted to emphasize the benefits and the wages, and I don't disagree, but from my point of view, what's been lost is the state of Wisconsin has lost the knowledge and the input of their workers that was communicated through the process collective bargaining.
Turning to private union membership, as we heard, a decline in Wisconsin, but that's more on a par with the rest of the country. What do you see when you look at Wisconsin's private sector union membership over the years?
Well, I think Haley made a good point. The right to work laws are not particularly critical. I mean, Iowa has had right to work laws, and their private sector unions don't look much different than ours either before or after we adopted them. And the other thing that your listeners should understand is this goes back long before Haley started getting data in 1985. Private sector unionism hit a peak in about 57 or 58 and has declined ever since. So, you know, we're approaching something like, 70 or 75 years of decline in private sector unionization. And I don't see any reason that that's going to turn around unless there's some fundamental change in the federal laws having to do with how unions are organized.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that again on the private sector side, that long-term decline. Is that a story of federal laws have become more burdensome for those wanting to start and maintain unions? Or has something changed about our workplaces, the size of our workplaces, the concentration of workers in one place? What is the story behind that decline in private union membership?
I don't think the changes in federal law are as important as the change that management has undergone to take advantage of those federal laws. So it's just much harder to organize, in part because I think most, not all, but most American management views unionization as a failure of management. And they don't want to lose the ability to make decisions or share them in any way with their workers. I mean, just to give you an example, if you're trying to organize a union and you're fired because you're trying to organize the union, the law has always said you need to be reinstated. But that law wasn't as routinely broken 50 years ago as it is now. Now we just view it, management often just views it as a cost of doing business to break that law, rehire or buy those people off. So it's just harder to organize. But I do think you made another good point, which is the economy has changed. The traditional easy place to organize was a large manufacturing plant. You had a lot of workers, so there were economies of scale in organizing, and they were doing similar jobs. And it was easier to create a sense of solidarity for a union organizer, and the benefits of organizing came quickly. That's no longer true, especially we have people working from home, people doing very different jobs, average firm sizes are smaller. So that is important too. That doesn't mean that there hasn't been some changes. I mean, we've started to see, even in sort of disaggregated service industries, bits of growth in unionization. For example, the sort of store-by-store Starbucks unionization that slowly seems to be happening, just as one example.
I wonder if there's a culture change. Because, you know, in the 1980s, you might not have been in the union, but you certainly knew someone who was in a union. Somebody growing up today, that might not be true. Are we getting to a point where even the thought of unions is off the radar for a lot of people entering the workforce now?
I think to some extent. I mean, I routinely start my classes by asking how many of you have been in a union, very few hands. How many of you had a parent in a union, more hands. How many of you had a grandparent in a union, more hands still. So you're right that the sort of notion of having friends and neighbors in a union is less common than it used to be. The federal law remains that every non-unionized facility has the possibility of becoming unionized. So when we teach our human resource management students, we make it clear that you can't completely forget about unions. But from a general public point of view, maybe. One thing that cuts across it is that public opinion about unions has actually improved over the last handful of years, even as union membership has declined. And if you ask Americans, do you think workers should have an ability to influence their workplace together as a group, and you leave the word union off, you usually get an overwhelming majority telling us, yes, they should.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Always my pleasure, Rob. Take care.
That's John Haywood, Distinguished Professor of Economics at UW-Milwaukee. Earlier, we talked to Haley Brown, labor researcher with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, author of a new report called States of the Unions, The Shifting Geography of U.S. Labor. Been talking about trends in Wisconsin's union membership rates 15 years after the passage of Act 10 here in the state.